I don't expect there is something will get change in Israel and with the Israel policies. The people already elect, they elect Netanyahu and the right wings. They are still control for the political scenes in Israel with Ben-Gavir and all this party, all this wings, right wings parties. So I don't expect there is something big changes in the with the with Netanyahu policies, especially he gets support from U.S. U.S. government, they said they are support Israel to protect themselves. U.K. government, they said the same. They said they, we are support and we understand, we accept how Israel protect themselves. But in the same time, no one talk about what's happened or what's going on with the poor people, with the normal people in Jenin refugee camp, or for the people in Palestine already, they fight for to get their rights and get their liberation.
We want to thank you for being with us, Mustafa Shitta, General Manager of the Jenin Freedom Theater, and speaking to us from the refugee camp. And I'm Judd Araki, Senior Editor at 972 Magazine, speaking to us from Haifa. Next up, we go to France to look at what's driving a week of protest over the police killing of Nahal Merzouk, a 17-year-old teenager of North African descent. Stay with us. Movie soundtrack to Athena by Generation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to France, which has seen a week of nationwide protests following the police killing last week of Nahal Merzouk, a 17-year-old of North African descent. He was killed during a traffic stop in Nanterre, a suburb of Paris. His death was captured on video. More than 3,000 people have been arrested. Tens of thousands of police descended on the demonstrations. Many protesters are now appearing in court, and the justice minister has called for prosecutors to seek prison sentences in some cases. We turn now to France, which and so we're going to go right now to Rachaya Diallo. Rachaya Diallo is a French journalist, a writer, a filmmaker, contributing writer for The Washington Post. She's a researcher in residence at Georgetown University. Her latest opinion piece in The Guardian is headlined, "France has ignored racist police violence for decades. This uprising is the price of that denial." Rachaya, can you start off by just describing what's taken place and talk about the simmering tension that was ignited with the killing of this young man?
Yes, thank you so much for telling about what's going on today in France. So what first initiated the uprisings was the death of a teenager, Nahal, who was killed in a traffic stop by the police. And what really outraged the people who are now in the streets was the fact that it was captured and the fact that we could hear the sound, and the sound could really showed something very threatening to Nahal. And he was killed so quickly that, and Nahal is also, it's important to underline that he's also from North African origin. So he belongs to a category of the population that is over policed, over-targeted by police brutality and police abuses. So that's why people were so angry. Many of the people who went to the streets right after his killing were people who looked like him and who some of them think that they could have been targeted in the same way.
And what do we know about Nayel Merzouk in terms of the victim himself? Why do so many young people of whose families came originally from North Africa or other former French colonies identify with what he went through?
Yes, like... there are figures who were issued by an entity, a body, like it's an institutional body that is... that aims to tackle discrimination, and according that body, which name is the Defender of Rights, if you are a young man perceived as North African Arab or perceived as black, you are 20 times more likely to be checked by the police than if you belong to any other category. So that means that we do have figures. We know that certain groups in the population are... is explicitly targeted, and they are more likely to be checked and also to be killed. There have been a law that was voted in 2017 that actually enables easier use of firearms by the police officers. It has made it easier for the police to use their firearms, and most of the people who have been killed are from an immigrant background. If you read their names, most of their names sound North African, African, and it sounds like they're really part of the largest group of victims as a consequence of that law.
And what's been the response of President Emmanuel Macron to the uprisings and the disturbances around the country?
So the response before the uprisings, his response was very quick and very uncommon, actually, because he said that the death of Nael was inexcusable. He also said that it was inexplicable, which I don't agree with, since we've had figures for a long time and we know that those things unfortunately happen. And what happened first, also I forgot to mention that, is that before the video was spread on social media, the police issued a report saying that Nael was dangerous and he was driving in car towards them. The video showed that it was not the case. So it also means that we can think that other people have been facing the same kind of situation, and as it wasn't captured, we don't know what really happened. The police, at the end of the day, issue reports that fit to their version of the story, but it's not always the truth. So Macron said that first that it was inexcusable, but then he really had hard stance against the uprising, and he blamed it on the parents, saying that he was considering sanctions towards the parents who had their children taking part to the uprisings.
I wanted to turn to Nahal's mother, Mounia, who has led protests through Nanterre in the Parisian suburb, calling for justice for her son. In a video published online, she said Nahal was her best friend, and his last words to her before he was killed were, "I love you."
I have lost a child of 17 years old. I was all alone with him. They took a baby away from me. He was still a child. He needed his mother. This morning he gave me a big kiss and said, "Mom, I love you." I said, "Look after yourself." I told him, "I love you. Look after yourself." There you go. We left at the same time. He went to get a McDonald's. I went to work like everyone. 1 hour later, what do they tell me? "We have shot your son." What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I live for him. I bought him everything. I gave him everything. I only have one. I don't have 10. I only have one. He was my life. He was my best friend. He was my son. He was everything for me. We were accomplices like you can't imagine.
And this is Nadia, the grandmother of Nahal Merzouk. She's asked to only be identified by her first name.
I blame the police officer who killed my grandson. That's all I'm angry with. We have the police, and lucky for us that we have the police. And the people who are breaking things, I tell them, stop it, stop it. They're doing this with Nael as a pretext. No, people should stop. They should stop. They should not break store windows. They should not ransack schools.
Rokhaya Diallo, your final comment. I know mayors, 200 of them have just met with the president. They're very unhappy with what's happening all over the country, what you expect to see next.
It's very difficult to know what expected to be seen next. I wish there was a real and profound discussion about police brutality, about racialized policing that occurs in those neighborhoods which are the banlieue surrounding the big cities, because it has not been part of the conversation, and that's the problem. The problem is that the UN issued a statement to say that France has to deal with it. Very deep problem of racism, but it has been dismissed by the French authorities, by the government. It hasn't been taken into account as something that should be dealt with. And I have the feeling that we reached an inflection point with the death of Nael, but unfortunately, it's backfiring. A fund has been created to support the police officer who was, who authored the killing, and it has gathered over 1.5 million euros. So that means that the country is really divided, and many people don't get that the victim is Nael, and the reason why he was killed has much to do with the structural inequalities in France.
Rokhaya Diallo, we want to thank you so much for being with us, French journalist. We'll link to your piece in The Guardian headline, France has ignored racist police violence for decades. This uprising is the price of that denial. Next up, as the Supreme Court blocks Biden's student debt relief plan, we'll speak with the debt collective's Astra Taylor. Stay with us.
I'm so happy 'cause today I found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, 'cause so are you. Book on is Sunday morning, is every day for all I care. I'm not scared, light my candles in our days, 'cause I found God.
Lithium by Nirvana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour looking at the two major Supreme Court decisions that came down Friday. First, we look at how the court blocked President Biden's student debt relief plan, which sought to cancel up to $20,000 in individual loans, adding up to over $400 billion of federal student debt. The 6-3 decision by the ultra-conservative-led court came as a major blow to some 40 million qualified borrowers. President Biden announced his administration would pursue a new path for debt relief. For more, we go to Astra Taylor, organizer with the Debt Collective. Can you respond to what took place on Friday, Astra?
This was a baseless lawsuit that absolutely should have been thrown out of court. And in fact, that is exactly what Justice Kagan says in her dissent, which I recommend everybody read. You know, the ultra-conservative majority had to twist themselves into a pretzel to hear this case. And in the words of Justice Kagan, they violated the Constitution in their decision to strike down Biden's debt relief plan. They arrogated power to themselves and basically said, no, we're ignoring the laws that Congress has passed. We're ignoring the action of the president. And we're saying that this debt relief cannot move forward. So it was a blow to debtors. It was a blow to anyone who cares about democracy, because they actually relied on something called the Major Questions Doctrine, which is a made-up statutory interpretation that basically says we, the Supreme Court, can decide on anything and block agencies from serving the public good. They used this to strike down environmental regulations from the Environmental Protection Agency and now to block student debt relief. So it's a blow, but the silver lining, and it's a small one, but you know we have to keep organizing and pushing it, is that Biden did announce what we've been calling a Plan B. We've been saying for years and years that he has other legal authorities to cancel student debt. He promised to use it. It's called the Higher Education Act. So now the question is not whether he will use the Higher Education Act to deliver on student debt relief, but how. And it's important that the Biden administration act fast, because time is of the essence.
And Astro, in terms of acting fast, isn't the problem with the alternative that Biden is proposing, the rulemaking process will take months, if not possibly years, to actually go through the required steps of that rulemaking?
Yes, and the thing is that other legal experts and advocates have made clear that they actually do not need to go through a rulemaking process. We have always been clear, the Debt Collective, that the Higher Education Act grants the president the authority to actually wipe out all student debt immediately. We wrote an executive order that we've been circulating for a long time. So, you know, this is something that absolutely can happen quickly. And that's imperative because we need to be on the high ground here. We've seen that the Supreme Court is lawless. Again, they violated the Constitution, in the words of Justice Kagan. So what we want to do is be fighting this reactionary court on the higher ground. People haven't gotten the debt relief that they were promised and that they are counting on, and that will be life-changing for people. So, you know, there is no guarantees. I think this is why this is an important issue for everybody who cares about democracy. We're seeing all of their decisions, you know, from striking down affirmative action to legalizing discrimination to gutting environmental protections. You know, we want to fight them in a bold, robust way, and debt cancellation is something that is fully within the president's power. The laws are absolutely clear. Congress delegated this authority to the Secretary of Education Act, through multiple laws. So we just want people to get the relief they are counting on. And we are going to keep pushing the administration to do this the best way possible.
Can we talk about language for a minute, Astra? You're using terms like relief, debt cancellation. Mm-hmm. You're not saying debt forgiveness, which is often used in the media. Explain why.
Absolutely. The debt collective rejects the language of debt forgiveness, which implies that debtors did something wrong, that there's a moral culpability there, that debtors should feel ashamed, right, should be begging for forgiveness. We say that borrowers did nothing wrong. 43 million people who have student debt because they pursued an education. This is something we are all entitled to as human beings. We're also entitled to medical debt cancellation because we all deserve health care. So we talk about debt cancellation, debt abolition, debt relief to push back on that moral framework. And in fact, what we think is that it is the creditors, in this case, the Department of Education, that should be held morally culpable, that is should be blamed for the student debt crisis. So that's why we couple our demand for the abolition of all student debt with the demand for free public college for all, for everybody, as well as free health care and other vital public services. And those are the public services that this Supreme Court is dedicated to blocking in an autocratic and very dangerous way.
And Astra, could you talk about the impact of the court's decision last week on financial companies, especially companies like SoFi Technologies that provide a lot of private student loans?
Well, this is the outcome that private loan servicers were rooting for. You know, SoFi had filed a lawsuit to block the COVID moratorium on payments, the payment freeze that has been in place since March of 2020. So this is obviously something that the private sector doesn't want. It's something that, you know, it was very clear in some of the lawsuits that didn't make it all the way to the Supreme Court that employers were upset with the idea of debt relief because it would give employees a bit more leverage, a bit more freedom. So absolutely, this is something that big business doesn't want. But I think it's actually important to note that a loan servicer was invoked in the student debt case that was decided on Friday, which is called Nebraska versus Biden. And Republican states basically claimed to be suing on behalf of a loan servicer called Mohila, which is based in Missouri. And that loan servicer actually distanced itself from the case, said it didn't want anything to do with it, didn't participate in it. So this is part of the baselessness of this lawsuit. A loan servicer in that instance actually didn't sue. It actually, and yet was used as a kind of prop in order to justify this decision.
Astra Taylor, we want to thank you for being with us. And we also encourage people to go to democracynow.org to see our interview with David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect, who took on the very issue you're addressing right now, Astra. Astra speaking to us from North Carolina. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we're going to turn right now to another Supreme Court decision. In another setback for equal rights, the conservative majority Supreme Court also ruled 6-3 Friday in favor of a Christian Colorado web designer who refused to create websites for same-sex couples, even though the state, Colorado, bans such discrimination. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote in the dissent decision that the decision was heartbreaking and a reactionary exclusion. Democracy Now! Spoke to the New Republic reporter Melissa Gira-Grant Friday, who reported that part of the lawsuit that the Alliance Defending Freedom filed on behalf of Lori Smith of Colorado was fake.
So in 2016, this website designer named Lori Smith, whose business is called 303 Creative, she believed that a Colorado anti-discrimination ordinance that protects people from discrimination, among other things, from discrimination based on sexual orientation, she believed that that precluded her from entering into the wedding website business. Now, she has never created a wedding website for anybody, and including a same-sex couple. So in the course of making this argument, she claimed, you know, two things. One, that this law meant that she couldn't post an announcement on her website saying that she wouldn't make these websites for any couple that wasn't in a biblical marriage that she approved of. And additionally, in a later filing in that original case in 2016, she claimed that an actual same-sex couple sought to have her build a website for them. That an inquiry, it doesn't seem that it was a legitimate inquiry, but it remained in the case. It came up in the district court ruling that ruled against her. It came up in their appeal. It's even been included in filings to the Supreme Court and was referenced by her attorneys, Alliance Defending Freedom, who are a Christian Nationalist Law Project. They said, hey, she's had an actual inquiry. So this is a case that, you know, has some relevance. But before this inquiry became a subject of debate, it hadn't really been reported out until I was able to reach the person who allegedly made the inquiry.
To see our full interview with Melissa Gira-Grant, go to democracynow.org. We're joined right now by Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. He's president and CEO of Interfaith Alliance, which, along with 30 other faith-based and civil rights groups, filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case, 303 versus Eleni. Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, thanks so much for being with us. Can you talk about what this means? If a private company can discriminate against the LGBTQ community, can they put a sign in a window of a store that says, we don't serve gays? Can they put a sign in the window of a store, we don't serve Jews, we don't serve blacks, we don't serve Latinos? What does this decision mean?
Well, it's thank you for having me on. I'm delighted and frustrated that this is the reason we're talking. We're entering into a terrible moment where a Pandora's box has been opened, and we're not sure exactly what it means. But what it does mean, for sure, is that permission has been granted to use religion as a way to discriminate against your fellow people. And we're going to see how this happens. It's not in a vacuum. This is happening already when LGBTQ people are under attack with religion as a pretext. And this gives permission for a lot of bad behavior. And what we have to just say is we are in a situation where what is legal cannot be considered moral. And what the law is cannot be considered just. And so, you know, we have a Supreme Court that has basically put down an adverse decision, which is bad for religion, and it's also bad for discriminated areas. Like, it could be race. It could be other protected groups. And we just haven't—we have to see how this plays out. But it's bad news for America.
And Reverend, could you talk about the Alliance Defending Freedom that backed this suit? What do we know about it, and how was it able to get this case all the way up to the Supreme Court?
Well, this is essentially a group that works with Christians, using Christianity as a bludgeon to discriminate. They use religious freedom in a way that it was never intended, and they they have had other cases that they have brought, and they have been successful. And so we're in a moment where they saw the Supreme Court opportunity, and they took it all the way up. And unfortunately, there was very little that the dissenting justices could do aside from pointing out the obvious that we are now in a moment. I'll quote Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who says, "Today the court, for the first time in its history, grants a business open to the public a constitutional right to refuse to serve members of a protected class." I mean, that's what this law group has done, and that's what the Supreme Court went along with.
So, Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, you are a gay Baptist minister. Talk about the religious community's response. And also, you supported the passage of the Respect for Marriage Act. How does this decision affect that?
Well, I think this shows why the Respect for Marriage Act was so important, is that it codifies the ability for families like my own to be protected against discrimination, and that our marriages are not to be dissolved. By the way, the Respect for Marriage Act, it protects also interracial marriages, which this photographer with her fake case could also say, "I don't want to photograph interracial marriages." So, for me, this hits me on a lot of levels. One, it hits me as a gay man with a husband and two children, who, of course, this now opens up the possibility that we could go into an establishment and they can say, "Oh, well, we don't want to, don't want to do your portrait." Where, who knows to what extent people will be able to discriminate against my family. But it's also really bad for religion. I have to say that, because people might think, "Oh, this is a victory for freedom of religion." Actually, one of the main, I'll put on my pastor hat here. Like, one of the main reasons that people are leaving the church, especially young people, they cite the antagonism that they perceive the church has against LGBTQ people. And this is just, this is just going to make more and more people say, "Ugh, who wants to have anything to do with religion or Christianity?" And that's, I think, for me, that's terrible, because it's a terrible understanding of what Christianity is and who Jesus was. It's also just does not reflect the fact that the majority of religious people in America support anti-discrimination laws for LGBTQ people. That's the fact. They don't want, this is not just the American people at large, but also the majority of almost every religious community rejects the idea that there should be discrimination against LGBTQ people in just such a way as the court has decided. And so basically, the court is representing a very small and diminishing part of the public in this decision. And it's just bad for religion. It's bad for freedom. And it's bad for America. It's bad for the fabric of America. It disintegrates the fabric of America.
And Reverend, we just have about 20 seconds left. But what should faith groups that are opposed to this decision, what recourse, what next steps would you recommend?
Well, we need to be rallying all over the country, and we need to be standing up, and we need to be very loud to insist that religion should be a cause for celebration, not discrimination, a cause for liberation, not subjugation, a cause for a bridge, not a bludgeon. And we have to say, just because this law is now the law, doesn't mean it's moral. And we have to stand up and say, if you're doing this, you are not representing a good religion, you're representing bad religion. It's very important that everyone stand up and be very clear about where they stand on this law.
Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, we thank you so much for being with us, joining us from Massachusetts, President and CEO of Interfaith Alliance. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.